I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Finance, March 10, 2005. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Cornish.
Here.
Ellison.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Neslow. Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman. Tamar.
Here.
Bodstrom.
We do have a quorum, so we'll first look at the minutes from the meeting of March 9, 2005. They're in the packet. Is there a motion?
No move.
That Representative Johnson moves approval of the minutes from that date. Any discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We're going to move to item 5 on the agenda, Representative Anderson B., House File 467. Chair moves the bill, so it is before our committee for presentation at this time.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Thanks for being here. I am Representative Bruce Anderson, and I've been before you, House File 467. I thank you for moving the bill, Mr. Chairman. And members, we bring this bill before you on the behalf of members who are motorcyclists throughout the state of Minnesota, Abate, and other members of the motorcycle concerns. We have individuals out there who in the past have enjoyed the luxury of being outdoors and allowing the breezes of Minnesota to blow through their hair and through their bodies, and it's a great joy for those people, and many members here are probably have experienced that themselves. But we're concerned today, Mr. Chair and members, about the many fatalities that have taken place because of mistakes or accidents that probably have been overlooked or for some reason not been careful in their driving experiences. I know I've talked to members even yesterday about the situation with this bill that they themselves in driving vehicles did not see a motorcycle and had an almost near accident with them. Mr. Chair, I have with me this morning former Representative Tom Workman, who represents Abate. He's here to testify and give some information on that, but I did ask research to give me some information on fatalities that have happened. This comes from Minnesota Motor Vehicle Crash Facts. Just for your information, members, in 2001, there were 42 motorcyclists who were killed in traffic crashes. This was an increase of over the year 2000 of when there was 35 motorcycle fatalities. In year 2002, there were 47 motorcyclists who were killed in traffic crashes, and in 2003, an increase to 62 motorcyclists who were killed in traffic fatalities. And there's much more information on these fact sheets about that situation. And Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment that if we can move that amendment, that would be great. It's H.O. 467A1 to put on the bill in lieu of the language that we have before you.
Chair moves the amendment so that the author can get the bill in the shape that he chooses. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, at this time I'd like to have Mr. Workman address the body.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members, thanks for having me. This morning I am Tom Workman, and I represent Abate of Minnesota, which is American Bikers for the Awareness, Training, and Education of Bikers. I myself am a biker, and I myself almost became one of those statistics in 2003. I think I did become one because I did sustain an injury. It was nobody's fault but my own, I'm here to tell you. I continue to blame sand on a road and a shoulder before I hit the Jersey wall. And if you want to learn more, talk to me later. But we have very seriously changed how this bill came out originally in through the hard work of Representative Anderson and others, and this group of bikers is somewhat vulnerable out there on the roadway. If you are a biker, you know that you are probably 10 times more alert when you're watching other traffic. I know I am versus when I'm driving in my pickup truck and doing other things than when I'm on my motorcycle. But I thought I might see the bicyclists here today. I suppose a pedestrian group could be there or any other organization that uses our roadways because I do know, talking to Allison Hartlett, the bicyclists, that they have a very similar issue to ours. But this group, the bikers group, is all about freedom, and so it isn't our credo to say, as the original bill did, that everybody's going to be a felon if they do something. We don't want to throw grandma or our kids or others into jail. But what is going on is a repeated story is told by bikers, and I do have a very typical story I can read of a young lady up in northern Minnesota that they just didn't see us. They just did not see the motorcyclist or the bicyclist or other. And there are very real stories of people getting killed. There's a story of a gentleman from down in Spring Valley who was the fourth bike in an eight-bike group. The three bikes went by. Him and his wife were, as a vehicle, just drifted over. The gentleman was looking at some land, came over the center line, and striking the fourth bike in the eight-bike group. The woman, the wife of the gentleman, did die. Nothing has ever come of that mistake. The woman that had emailed me, her name is Dawn Gerke, and on August 23, 2003, I and my life partner were riding our motorcycle through a busy little town in Minnesota. It was a beautiful evening, about 8 p.m. We were about to cross through a traffic light in a controlled intersection. We were struck by a car making a left turn. That is what mostly bikers are talking about. They're just going through an intersection. They have the right of way. A vehicle turns right in front of them. And you've seen the bumper stickers that say start seeing motorcycles. That's usually the first thing that someone says after they struck a motorcycle is, you know, I never saw them. That is, in fact, why we like more lights on the front of our bikes and louder pipes. And I know those sometimes do conflict with other people. But her partner and I were thrown from the motorcycle, and both the motorcycle and us sustained heavy damage to numerous areas. My partner flew over the car, and I hit the car also, but slid off and landed in front of the vehicle. My partner sustained a very badly broken ankle and a severe bump on his head. Collided the windshield. The motorcycle was broken in pieces, right in two, and several pieces all over. I had a cut so bad that when they sewed it back up, my own skin did not take back to the site. The doctors kept me for a week. I won't get too into the gory details. We were not traveling at an excessive speed. Our headlight was on, and we had the right of way. In fact, we couldn't have been going any faster than 15 miles an hour. I had landed in the hospital for 3 weeks, had faced three surgeries, and now have three very ugly scars on my legs. And she does end by saying that they now call her patches in her group. I did not walk away. I needed a walker and crutches for the following 6 months. I missed work for 6 months, and my medical coverage paid $41,000 for my injuries and hospital stay. The driver of the vehicle was not tested for alcohol at the scene of the accident, nor did he go to jail. The young man who hit us walked into court, paid a $165 fine, and went home. I'd like to see stronger and stiffer penalties for those who fail to yield the right-of-way or at least have something put on his permanent driver's record. After all, he was only 17. And again, I think the group understands that 17-year-old, I have a 16-year-old at home that's driving and a 19-year-old, that people do make mistakes. Where we have disagreed with some people is we don't want to keep the system from prosecuting people that should be prosecuted for a felony, that aggressiveness usually shows up when somebody is speeding or driving carelessly or they've been drinking. The system wants to go after those people. But for people who just make a mistake, a $70 ticket, which we are hearing is often very common, really does not do enough. And so it's been argued they should have their license taken away, they should go to jail, they should they receive a bigger fine, and other things. And that's how we arrived at the amendment, Mr. Chairman, to bring the bottom up from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor for actually great bodily harm and death. And so, Mr. Chairman, if there's any questions I can answer at this point, I stand ready.
Any questions? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, generally, in the criminal law, is reserved for intentional conduct or behavior that is so inherently dangerous and risky that it can be said that the person didn't care whether they hurt somebody or not. But failure to yield the right of way it can have horrible consequences, as you clearly pointed out, and you've made that case very well. But inside of the human being who makes that mistake, you know, the intent isn't there. And of course, the civil penalties the person who injures somebody is fully liable for their injuries, fully liable for their personal injury loss if they cause that accident. So I guess, could you help make a finer point for me why we would depart from the traditional criminal law, which involves intentionality or reckless disregard, when we talk about enhancing and increasing criminal liability? Why would we depart from that, given that the civil tort system is there, given those realities?
Well, I think the work with Representative Ellison and Mr. Chairman, there was recently a very public, and this issue became a very public issue when former Governor and Congressman Janklow in South Dakota, and maybe it's not a real good comparison because he had prior speeding violations and other things, but surely he didn't have the intent to kill that biker down in southern Minnesota. The biker community believes that what we've found is that from the law enforcement area into the prosecution area, there's such a wide variety of concepts about what to do with a person who does this to somebody else and causes great bodily harm, and that the level of seriousness in the minds of those individuals isn't there. As I read Ms. Gehrke's comments, and the gentleman down in Spring Valley whose wife died at Mayo Clinic, it's still tied up since last June, and he doesn't know if anybody's been charged or not. It seems to be from the police officer level that it's very quickly accepted that it was just an honest mistake, and that that oftentimes no ticket or a very minor ticket is charged. We think that sends the wrong signal to individuals for whatever their reason for not seeing another vehicle on the roadway. And so I believe that what is going on now is a serious downward departure from the seriousness of this question.
Representative Nelson. Mr. Chair, Mr. Werke, a question I have here is as I'm reading this, this is nothing. This is not specific to motorcycles. So if I'm driving a car and I hit another car and cause damage, the same. I mean, is that way I read this that the same day or the same penalties would apply to me if I run a red light or if I don't see somebody I drive, you know, to take it right away and cause bodily damages, then I'm going to do the same thing. This doesn't give. I know buses have superior right of ways when they're pulling away from the curb. This doesn't grant them an extra right of way like the buses currently have when they're pulling from the curb, that they basically have the right of way to pull out in traffic where the traffic's there and you have to stop for them. That's not doing the same thing here.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I thought I heard maybe two questions.
Questions, yeah.
It is not just for the motorcyclists. We'd be willing to do that, but I don't. That's perhaps an arrogance we don't want to be involved in. Again, the bicyclists and other individuals on the roadway. But no, I'm not positive I can answer the question about the buses. We're not granting them any more.
Take a 2-second break. I'd like to, at this time, we have a group of students in our committee room today, and I'd like to introduce them. They are sophomore students from Holy Family Catholic School of Victoria, Minnesota, visiting us today. Welcome. Any additional questions of the author? Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again, Representative Workman. I have one question. Could you tell us, is there a precedent for this in other states, and what kind of where that lies in the way other states deal with this issue?
Mr. Workman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastland, and I promised the County Attorney's Association, and I am collecting the information, Oregon, North Carolina, West Virginia, New Mexico, states all across the nation are addressing this issue in a variety of different ways, but they're increasing the criminal, it might be in West Virginia where they have a point system. They're dramatically increasing the points on your driver's license, among other things, to raise the specter of this problem. So it is occurring. I will be getting that information collected.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I'll just follow up. Follow up question is along with that. So there is. We don't have any data necessarily that indicates what other states are doing in this arena. My follow up question was: Is there any clear indication that moving in this direction of increasing penalties will actually have the effect of making somebody notice a motorcycle that wouldn't have in the past on a daily, you know, when we're out there in the mundane world looking at the land? Is this really going to change the outcomes, or is this going to do something different than that? I'm not sure. Could you react to that?
Mr. Workman.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastland, honestly, I'm not positive about that, but will .08 keep me from drinking and driving? Further, does the death penalty keep me from murdering somebody? You know, I mean, I think there's I've always subscribed to the theory that we have so many laws that we aren't all positive exactly which one we're breaking at any given moment. But which is nice cover for me, but. You know, so I'm not sure to the exact answer to that, but we certainly believe that it will, and certainly that we hope it will.
Anything else? Any further?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to reiterate the fact that there was some information that was given to me from research about bicyclists in the year 2001. There was over 1,000 individuals that were hurt on bicycle crashes in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Anderson, I apologize. Do not deliver your conclusion, because we do have another scheduled witness, and that's Hillary Caligari, Office of the Hennepin County Attorney.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that.
Yes, element. Welcome. Give us your name and then go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Hillary Caligiuri. I'm here today representing the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Our original intent today was to testify in opposition to the bill as it was introduced. The County Attorneys Association has not taken a formal position on the bill with a gross misdemeanor amendment. So I can't give you a formal position on that, but I can raise a couple of concerns for you based on our discussion of the original bill. Under current law, we already do have the tools to prosecute the type of cases that this bill is trying to go after as felonies. We already have those tools. When there's gross negligence involved, that already is a felony crime. So these types of cases, like Bill Janklow blowing a stop sign in South Dakota and killing a Minnesota motorcyclist, is prosecutable in Minnesota as a felony crime, because that would be, I believe, prosecuted as a gross negligence felony. Janklow, remember, was convicted in South Dakota, and I think he would have been here too. One irony with this proposal at the gross misdemeanor level is that it would actually make it more difficult for us to prosecute the truly egregious, reckless cases, because the argument would be that the legislature has decided that a failure to yield when it results in great bodily harm is a gross misdemeanor. It's not a felony. And so that would actually make it tougher for us in those cases where the actor truly is very culpable, grossly negligent, reckless. And as has been pointed out here today, this bill would cover cases where there was not gross negligence, where there was an accident, there was not necessarily that culpability. Our more broad concern, and it applies both to the bill in its original form and to the bill as it's amended here today, is that it takes just one slice of negligence and imposes greater penalties on that particular slice of negligence. This is effectively a strict liability bill for all intersection accidents. If you look at any intersection accident, somebody will have failed to yield. And I understand that a member of this committee personally has had this happen. Failed to yield, not through gross negligence, not through recklessness, but it does happen. So this bill would be strict liability in those types of cases. If you take a person who stops at an intersection, comes to a complete stop, looks both ways, and for some reason doesn't see an approaching car or motorcyclist, either their vision is blocked or maybe their senses just aren't as good as they used to be, they drive out into the intersection and an accident happens and somebody is hurt. Then, on the other hand, take somebody who is driving too fast, goes around a corner, rolls, and somebody's hurt in that type of a situation. Both of those drivers are negligent. I would argue that there's more negligence in that speed case because the speeder is making the decision to go 70 and a 50 or whatever it is, and that's causing that rollover. He loses control of the car. But both actors are negligent. This bill just focuses on this very, very narrow slice of negligence and would impose a higher penalty not on that speeder but on the failure to yield case. And so for proportionality purposes, we're just not sure that that makes sense. Like I said, we don't have a formal position on the gross misdemeanor bill as amended, but I hope that these concerns are helpful to you. Thank you.
Any questions of this witness? Thank you very much. Representative Anderson, do you want to have a seat and wind up your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your patience and indulgence in our testimony and for Mr. Workman to be here this morning. Just to let you know that I have a young woman who just 3 years ago, maybe it's longer than that, but it seems like it's only a few years ago, that she and her boyfriend were riding a motorcycle, and he was killed. She was severely injured, and she is lives in my district, lives close by. And that's a reason, one of the reasons that we brought this forward, because of not only her, but for her chapter in Buffalo, or Wright County, the members that have had close calls with motorcyclists. And members, I appreciate your looking into this further and thinking about it, pondering it, and giving it your best shot forward and making a final decision. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us to be before your committee.
Representative Anderson, there does appear to be one additional question. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom,
yes.
What would your response be to the testimony that we received that in gross negligent cases,
passing this would actually make it more difficult to prosecute someone with a felony.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we understand the complications of the law, and we know that we've put, as Mr. Workman has always said, lots of laws in place, and it's made it difficult in some places for other situations, not just necessarily this situation of motorcycle crashes or bicycle crashes and things like that. I think it's something that we have to work out in the court system and the judicial system, and I think this brings at least a heightened awareness of the problem that we have out there, and hopefully, as Mr. Workman's alluded to, that other states are working on this, so we can come to a final agreement of either making this permanent situation in law, or we come up with a new solution. But I think we need to make it aware, because more and more people, as the facts show, it's increasing just from 2000 to 2003, 2004. That we're having more and more crashes and fatalities because people are making mistakes. And something's got to be done to at least heighten awareness. I mean, why do we pass laws for .08? It seemed like it was a situation like that. So I think that to have a firm answer on that, to make it harder, or to say that it makes it harder for the court system to do that, I think that we can work that issue out in time.
Representative Hillstrom, you had another one?
Yeah, just a fellow, former Representative Workman, sorry about that. Does your organization know and understand that by doing this, you make it more difficult for the person who is seriously neglectful or seriously reckless, and it inhibits our ability to charge them with a felony? Does your organization understand that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, that has been thrown out. I don't know that to be true or not to be true. Where we started with this was we didn't want to affect anybody at the top end and the felony end. Where our problem was on the bottom end, that people were either not getting a ticket or some small fine for killing somebody or seriously injuring them, unless they were intoxicated or doing something pretty wild. So we wanted to bring the bottom up, not affect the top. I think the argument that now we're not going to be able to prosecute somebody with a felony because of this language, I'm not sure I truly buy that. The other side of this issue really is a defense of sloppy driving. That's what the biker is faced with out there. There's a lot of sloppy driving out there, and for the other side to have to argue this is a difficult task. It's our children, it's our friends, our neighbors. They're driving sloppy. One day, nice sunny day, a lot of motorcycles out there. They drove sloppy. Oh well. That's what we're fighting. Again, bikers are freedom-loving individuals who aren't interested in throwing everybody in jail on everything. But to from the bottom end increase, it's either a misdemeanor, which isn't much, or it's a gross, which is a lot more. So maybe we need, what is the middle range there? The bikers want to see some movement in the law on this. We don't want to get in the way of prosecutors and others who are trying to keep the bad folks off the streets. We just think that if you seriously harm my spouse or kill her, and maybe we're not so much talking about the killing part, that something more than no ticket or a small $70 ticket is going to come and play. And I know we realize that's a big leap. But we don't want to affect the top end.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final statement. I really understand what you're doing. And I understand, and I'm sympathetic to, motorcyclists. I grew up riding a motorcycle with my father as well. My concern here is that, for example, if you leave your children with a babysitter, and they aren't paying attention, and your child drowns in the swimming pool, they aren't necessarily charged with a crime. It was a mistake. It was unfortunate. Maybe she was talking on the phone. She doesn't get charged with a crime. What you're saying here is that if someone happens to stop at the stop sign and they pull out and they didn't see someone, now they are a criminal. And I just want to make sure that, you know, we really balance this out and make certain that we want to criminalize, you know, honest mistakes. And that's where I struggle, because I am supportive in making certain that people can ride their bicycle and their motorcycles safely. I just don't want to criminalize true accidents.
Very good. Anything further? Representative Anderson, thank you. Chair lays your bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Ellison.
Just a question about process, Mr. Chair. If there are some members who don't necessarily favor this bill, when are we going to get a chance to address that issue?
Well,
I'm just in my second term, so maybe I don't get it, but when do we get to vote on this bill?
Okay, you've got two questions. When will you get to address the bill, and when will you get to vote on it? Your first question, the answer is, we've just spent almost 40 minutes, 35 minutes addressing the bill. So you've had an opportunity this morning. If you have additional questions of the author or of the witness, you may do so now. As far as taking up the bill for a vote, it'll be done at a later time with notice to the committee, which bills we will take off the table, perhaps all of them, and then as well as the authors and witnesses will be given advance notice.
And so, Mr. Chair, there's a chance that we're going to do everything we've done already all over again?
No.
On the bills?
Well, Representative Ellison, I hope we won't have another 35-minute hearing on this particular bill. If additional testimony is needed, well, strike the word needed, if it's requested by any member of the committee, you can let me know, and we will see that the witnesses are back. It would be my intent to go forward with the bills and or amendments that we've presented now and bring them up for a brief discussion and vote later on. Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
I want to take it down. Wait a minute. Representative Anderson, I did have one last question for you. There is a fiscal note in the file, and I have two questions. Number one, do you have any testimony or comments you want to present on the fiscal note now?
I don't.
All right. Then do you dispute any of the numbers in the fiscal note?
At this time, no, I don't.
Very good. Thank you.
Next item on the agenda today is House File 256. Representative Smith, would you like to move your House File?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I would like to move House File 256. And I do have an amendment. I don't know that it's in the packet. It may be being passed out now. It's H.O. 25683.
Are you planning on moving the A1 amendment?
I am not.
Okay.
Excuse me. This, Mr. Chair and members, I'll confess, is a work in progress. The A3 amendment was, I think, worked on even this morning. So I think the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, let me find it. Mr. Chair, I think, upon reflection, will offer the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like, and briefly, the amendment would carve out contraband so as not to include that in the returnable issue. So I'd move the A1 amendment.
Okay, so as an author's amendment, we'll just accept that as an author's amendment and incorporate it into the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Likewise, with A3, it's essentially a delete all. I'd like to have that incorporated and try to explain that.
Okay. Any objections from the committee? We'll just we'll incorporate that into the bill and put it in the shape you want.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question about the impact of the amendment that we put on to the bill first and then doing a delete all. Would we not want to amend the amendment onto the delete all amendment?
I may need some help myself. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, perhaps we did one before the other. If the record could reflect the A1 should be amended to the A3, Mr. Diebold.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment is not drafted as a delete-all. It's drafted as an addition, so it's a whole new section, and they can be taken in either order.
Okay, so if we understand everything, we have the original bill, and we have the A1 amendment, the A3 amendment presented by the author today to incorporate into that bill. So that will be the motion that that we will use the bill with the two amendments from the author. So why don't you proceed with your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, very good. I'm going to give you a brief description of the why and of the need and the bill, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Workman to elaborate on the need, and then I have Ms. Caligiuri from the head of the county attorney's office to walk through the bill as amended. Briefly, this also is a bill being advanced by abate. It's dealing with the issue of property that has been seized by authorities upon initial contact between a citizen and the authorities. I think for those who have been on this committee before, you've heard testimony in the past from individuals whose seized property was kept for an extensive period of time without charges being filed against that individual property owner. This legislation is an attempt to put some constraints on the system and allow the uncharged party a route that is not currently in law to go to in order to seek return of that property. And with that, I'd ask Mr. Workman to elaborate on the need.
Welcome, Mr. Workman. Go ahead with your testimony.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I don't know that I can do much more than the succinct comments of Representative Smith. This is an issue that is popping up with many individuals in the biker community, and why ABATE Minnesota and others have been trying to forward this concept, in that there's a lot of stereotypes about bikers. Hopefully I'm breaking some of those today, but if I belong to a motorcycle organization and I ride a motorcycle and I wear black leather, it is oftentimes assumed that I have certain other hobbies, manufacture of methamphetamines and other things. There are certain members of our community who have, in fact, have violated some of those things, but many others have been under suspicion. A search warrant is gotten. The individual is visited at his home. His computer is taken. His leather vest is taken. His motorcycle is taken. Files are taken. Everything but the individual is taken. 3 years later, the individual is still wondering what exactly is going on. I think through many of these amendments, we are not trying to get in the way of law enforcement, although they do seem to sometimes take a very long time to get at some things. We'd like our motorcycles back. If I'm not going to be charged, I'd like that back. And I think there was quite a flurry of activity here this morning, and through the County Attorney's Association and the police chiefs and others, we've tried to work, and we are working very closely with them to make sure that criminals that should be convicted of things are. But those individuals in the middle who are not being charged should be allowed to get their belongings back after a certain amount of time. I think one of the things, or one of the amendments that does help to take care of, is if I am being charged perhaps for, or is suspected that I'm being charged of a drug crime, and you've confiscated my drugs, then maybe is not a very good example. Unless there's a forfeiture, should be a forfeiture of my vehicle, my boat, my car, or whatever, because I was selling drugs out of my car, why do you have my motorcycle? If my motorcycle was not involved in the crime, why has my motorcycle been gone for 3 years? And so, or other personal property. And so any contraband or anything that really truly does need to be used in the investigation to establish those charges, fine. But if it cannot be established that you need my motorcycle, I would like it back. And that's why, in part, this is a biker bill.
Additional testimony?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The head of the county attorney's office, Ms. Caligiuri.
Okay, Ms. Caligiuri. Welcome. Would you state your name and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Hillary Caligiuri, again today representing the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I am here to not exactly support the bill, but to indicate that at the chair's request, Chairman Smith's request, the County Attorneys Association has assisted in drafting the language that you see before you in the A3, the Lead All Amendment, and that it's language that we can live with. And I don't know if you'd like me to walk through things. Okay. This amendment is an amendment to Minnesota Statute 626.04, which is the existing remedy for a person who claims that they have a right to receive property back once it's been seized, either with probable cause or under a search warrant by the police. The amendment does a number of things to simplify and streamline the process for a person who has such a claim. It would allow them to make a written request to law enforcement, whatever agency it is that has their property. And if the property is not returned within 48 hours, that person would have the right to file a petition with the district court. The district court is instructed to provide a form to make that simpler. And the fee is a civil motion filing fee, which I believe right now is $50. In some period of time where the custodian has 10 days notice, there will be a hearing. That hearing is going to be within 30 days. So this is intended to not allow this process to drag out. So within 30 days, there will be a hearing in front of a judge without a jury with a simple and informal procedure, meaning that the rules of evidence do not apply to what relevant evidence is heard in that hearing. The custodian of the evidence, whoever it is that has custody of that property, is permitted to speak with the judge in camera with just the custodian and the custodian's attorney, which would presumably be the prosecutor. In camera, they would summarize the status of the investigation, meaning, judge, this is where our investigation is, and this is why we still need this property because it is going to be charged, or this evidence is relevant to whatever piece of the investigation. So that will be summarized for the judge. And that record will be sealed. That's not something that will be available to the defense attorney or to the defendant under this bill. The court, the standard that's set forth in the statute is that the court shall not order the return of the property if it finds that it's being held in good faith as potential evidence. It might be subject to forfeiture, it's contraband, or it is, for some other reason, subject to lawful retention. So if the police have the right to still have the property, then the court will not order its return. The court will make findings on each of those pieces, and the bill provides that once the petitioner files that petition, they're no longer going to have to pay storage costs, because some property does subject the owner to storage costs in the police storage facility. And then after, this just changes the existing language to clarify a little bit that after the trial for which that property was being held and the expiration date for all the associated appeals, that evidence will be returned to its owner unless it's contraband or something that should be destroyed or have a different disposition. So that is the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can on it.
Just one question, Ms. Caligiuri. How many estimated cases do you think would be brought under this statute?
Mr. Chair, frankly, I don't believe that it would be used that frequently. The existing 626.04, which is a more bare-bones version of the same remedy, it's not as well spelled out, but it's always been there. And in my experience, it has not been used very frequently. I suppose the publicity surrounding enacting the law will make people more aware of that remedy. And also the fact that it's been simplified, the procedure has been simplified, there are forms available, might make it so that it happens more often. But just as a personal opinion, I'm guessing that it won't be that frequent.
You stood at the testimony, Mr. Smith?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Meswell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Caligiuri, perhaps I misunderstood what you were saying earlier. I thought you made a reference to the A3 amendment as a delete-all, and that would then mean that it was the county attorney's intention, county attorney's association's intention, that this procedure would replace the procedure originally set out in the first version of 256. But as I am looking at the terms of that amendment, it appears that it's not a delete-all, and that instead both procedures would become law. Is that the desire of the County Attorneys Association? And I guess once I've heard your answer to that, I would ask Representative Smith if that's his intention as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative Meslow, it's my understanding that the A3 was mistakenly not drafted as a delete-all, but is in fact intended as a delete-all, and so it would replace the procedures that are in the existing House File 256, which the county attorneys could not live with, put it that way.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Meslow. I'm sorry.
Same answer, same. Representative Meslow.
Thank you. Then it's my understanding that in the end, the end goal is to make this a delete-all so that the procedure set forth in A3 would replace the procedure set forth in 256, and that would satisfy both of you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Meslow, that's the intent, yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Meslow, yes.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and both testifiers.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
I guess I got a question. Another bill that's going through another committee about mandates, could this be construed as a mandate they were putting on local governments, and they could then, if this bill that goes through to relieve them of having unfunded mandates, could they then not abide by this law because of those? Because this is something that could fall into that same trap.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, since I'm speaking on behalf of the County Attorneys Association today, I apologize, but we haven't addressed that issue specifically, so I'm really not able to give you a good answer on that.
Another question?
Representative Nelson.
The other question I have is the courts. It seems to me that we're requiring a 30 days, they have to have a court hearing. Are we putting another burden on the courts that are already talking about problems, like being able to get enough staff to get the stuff done that they have to get done?
Ms.
Caligiuri.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that's possible. I'm not sure.
Representative Cornish.
Oh, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, the A1 amendment then that this one, would this also be superseded by the A3 intended delete all, or would the A1 still be in effect of that definition or that procedure?
I understand that's the definition.
Yeah, it's
labeled. Representative Cornish, where are we here?
Maybe council could help. The A1 was moved and the A3. My question would be, I don't have any problem with the A3 that satisfies everything I wanted in the bill, but the A1 is from problematic language. I wonder if that's still in effect then, or if that's replaced by A3.
Mr. Dybul?
Mr. Chair and members, technically the both sections are still in the bill, and so the A1 amendment was proper. It amended the language, but both testifiers have indicated that they don't want that language to survive, so either there could be a motion made to delete section 1 and put the bill in the form that the author wants, or it could be taken care of at a later date. But currently, as it's amended, the A1 is on, and if you have changes, you're open to do that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, what's the problem with the language?
Oh, the A1, the A3 there isn't, if that's intended as a delete all, but the A1 language, if I could have the information and policy analyst in the DNR, it talks about while our the property in the DNR has to do with wild animals and reverting back to the state and not back to the person. And then in felon with firearms, there's just a couple of ours that we could probably fix with a technical amendment just to make sure that they're not included, to do with firearms and to do with wild animals. But like I say, if the A1 language in front of me isn't in there, if the A3 replaced it, then there wouldn't be a problem.
Representative Smith, do you want to respond to that?
Not at this time. You can lay the bill over, and if there is a problem, we can work that out.
Okay. Any other questions of the committee? Are there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Okay, then the chair will lay the bill over for future consideration.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda today is House File 0204, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Representative. I will move House File 0204 to get it before us in the committee, and welcome. Would you proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have an author's amendment that I believe is going to be moved.
Do we know what number that is?
A2.
Where is it here? The A2 amendment. Okay, the A2 amendment. I'll move the A2 amendment, and we'll incorporate that into the bill. So why don't you go ahead and proceed with it.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, just to brief people, you'll notice in your packets there's an A1 and an A2 amendment. In the original legislation, there were some concerns regarding line 18 and 19 on the first page, where it read a vehicle engaged in providing regular route public transit. There were some concerns by emergency personnel that perhaps that was a little bit too open-ended. They wanted to tighten it up a little bit. The A1 amendment was originally drafted, and then after subsequent discussions, the A2 amendment was offered as a in preference to that. So the A2 amendment is the one we're going with. And what this does is just kind of tightens up the allowance for transit vehicles to have the traffic signal override device.
Okay, Representative Garofalo, if you would please describe your bill, and then we have two witnesses.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this regards the traffic signal override device or override system that's currently in use to allow emergency vehicles preference at stoplights. You'll see I passed out a handout to you regarding there's two sheets of paper. The front page is a link on the website of the company that sells this information. You can see that they are falsely... when people have questions about the legality of the purchase of their product for private use, they refer people to the Department of Transportation site in the state of Minnesota, which you can imagine doesn't offer people much. But more importantly, on the second page of this handout, you'll see an advertisement which was provided to me. This is from the magazine Guns and Stuff. And if the copy didn't come across well, but on the very top you'll see traffic light preemption, and you see right below it, it says fire, police, and then on the very far right, it says private, which I presume means that if people are in a hurry and they just want to get where they're going, you would purchase one of these systems. In my district, former state rep Steve Strand, now the chief of police for the city of Lakeville, they actually caught someone driving a Humvee with one of these things, and the individual admitted that he had purchased it for $600 online. So these devices are available, and what the purpose of this legislation to do is to prohibit their possession and use in motorized vehicles with the exceptions that are listed. So, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll take any questions at this time.
All right. Any questions of the author? Why don't we hear then from O.J. Doyle, Minnesota Ambulance? Is he? All right. Mr. Doyle and Mr. Representative Powell, you're both next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I'm late. I was in another committee. I had looked at this bill, or I just was alerted to this within the last 24 hours, and I had some concerns about allowing these devices on regularly scheduled buses. And I've spoken with Henry Erdman with the Firefighters Association. I've also talked with the MTC. The MTC seems to think my concerns can be allayed. However, and I have not had the chance to talk to Representative Garofalo, and I apologize. I hadn't had a chance yet. But I do have some concerns, and my first thought when I saw this, I'm trying to find it real quick. Yeah, on lines, page one, number, lines 18 and 19, my first thought when I saw this was, you know, somebody might get killed, and that somebody might be me. I drive emergency vehicles in Minneapolis constantly, and I would tell you one of the things that is always the most dangerous is this. When you have police and fire and ambulance going to the same scene from three different directions, you can bet that we're always looking out after for each other, because you never know when you're going to meet one of those other two vehicles on the street. So even though we all have single override devices, the problem becomes is that other people are blasting through these lights as well on lights and sirens. Now, it concerns me that all of a sudden that we can have city buses thrown into that mix. And I think it could create a very dangerous situation. So I pledge to work with, is this, I understand this is being laid over. And in between the time now and when you construct your bill, I hope to be able to work with Representative Garofalo and MPC, and perhaps I need some more education, but I also would like to have some input on this language. So that's my input on that, and thank you very much. Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association, and we share some of Representative Powell's concerns, and we, too, have pledged to work with Representative Garofalo on the language. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Nelson? I guess my question is, before Representative Powell leaves, is he seeing the A2 language, and is he aware of that, or does that give him comfort, or... and that deals with the two lines you were speaking of. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have seen this amendment, and Representative Nelson, thank you for that. I still have some concerns. The language now is better than it was. However, I still have some concerns with this as we move forward. But this does make it better. There's no doubt about that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Garofalo, thank you. If you have any closing remarks?
No, just thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the hearing and members of the committee. I look forward to hopefully this being considered in the omnibus bill out of this committee.
Thank you very much. The bill is laid over. Next, we'll take up House File 1218, Representative Powell, Vehicle Monitoring Device Installation Allowed in Authorized Emergency Vehicles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 1218 is regretfully before this committee. I know that...
Chair moves the bill, Representative Powell. Go ahead.
Thank you. These vehicle monitoring devices have been proven to be quite efficient in several different ways, and it's a little more than what I read here in the bill summary. they are there for monitoring what's going on in front of the vehicle, but where the really efficacy of these devices is this. It makes for safer drivers. They have alarms on them. They can be recorded. They do record driving habits of the operator. And for instance, Gold Cross Ambulance in Rochester found that about 50 or 60% of their problems were being caused by 15% of the drivers. And just simple counseling had a great impact on the safety of vehicle operation. They've also found that their tires lasted longer, their brakes, there was less time between their brake replacement, and the patients in the back reported their satisfaction with the ride to the hospital also increased. So this is a safety issue more than anything else. They also record events 20 seconds before, during the event, and 20 seconds after the event. That helps out with liability issues. There are some concerns sometimes when there's an accident. One driver will say the lights and sirens were on. Another driver will say the lights and sirens were off. So consequently, we feel that this is a very good device and should be made available to ambulances. The problem right now is that for some reason, the Department of Public Safety, the Attorney General's office, feel that they don't have the right to grant a waiver to current law, and that we would have to come in here and authorize these for all emergency vehicles. And so that's what this bill asks to do. And I have O.J. Doyle here. He was here. There he is. But the Ambulance Association, he has worked on this for 2 years. And again, regretfully, we've had to come to this point where we've had to try to put it into bill form.
Mr. Doyle.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I think Representative Powell pretty much summarized everything. This is part of a collective effort that we're putting forward at the legislature as a means to reduce the overhead or the cost of operating ambulance services and also enhancing safety for our personnel and for our patients. And where these have been used extensively in other states, there have been significant reductions in insurance premiums, accidents, and other untoward events involving the public and the personnel. I'm not sure if in your packets there is a handout information, photograph. Anyway, it's roughly the size of this cut in half, and it mounts up on the rear view mirror. It doesn't obstruct your vision, and you can get the cameras that record both the driver and forward, or just forward or just back. And we feel that there's no cost to the state on this. We feel that this would give us a great advantage in ensuring safety. We appreciate your support.
You have another witness, Representative Powell.
I do not, but I just would like to add is that in ambulances, the rearview mirror, that what we think is rearview mirrors in the middle of the windscreen, are useless when you look at them, for the driver anyway. When you look at them, all you see the bulkhead of the ambulance. So they're not used for vision. They're just there because the manufacturer put them there. They're not our help at all. We have other mirrors that we use. The other thing is I've spoken with this morning the manager of the Hennepin County Ambulance Service, and they've told me that as soon as this law is passed, they will be putting these on our ambulances. So there is a desire to have this available for emergency vehicles.
Any questions of the author? Representative Nelson.
Yes, I got a couple questions. One is, this doesn't cover, I've heard these advertisements of putting a device in your car to monitor how your kids drive, and you can, if they're having problems or whatever. This doesn't cover that. It's only emergency vehicles.
Representative Powell.
Representative Smith, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, that is correct. This is only for emergency vehicles. This right now, fire departments can use them, law enforcement. We're just adding, basically, by making it all emergency vehicles, we're encompassing EMS as well.
Representative Nelson.
My other question has to do with a discipline of personnel. Could this then be used as progressive discipline to go after an employee that's possibly, continually driving poorly or other doing other things that they decide at the future somebody decides they don't want their drivers to do, could these cameras then be used to capture those events?
Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, the short answer is yes. I think in those of us in police, fire, and EMS want to make sure that we have the have personnel that are behind the wheels of these vehicles driving as safely as possible. We all get into bad habits, and sometimes those bad habits need to be pointed out to you. And I've been doing over 30 years driving emergency vehicles, and I'm sure at times I've slipped into bad habits. Mm-hmm. So it's best that we're able to nip these things in the bud before you get a real dangerous driver out there and a dangerous operator.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill, straight over. Your last bill, or the last bill, Representative Powell, is 1156, State Patrol Vehicle Automatic External Defibrillators, funding provided. And I believe since the funding of this bill should ultimately get to the floor is from the trunk fund, Chair would move that the House File 1156 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to Transportation Finance. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My notes out here. House File 1156 allocates funds for the purchase of automated external defibrillators, or AEDs, for the use of the Minnesota State Patrol. As most of the committee is aware, these devices have a solid history of saving lives in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. In most instances, in cardiac arrest conditions, the only treatment is to deliver an electric shock called defibrillation. However, it is vital that this treatment be done within a few minutes of the event. CPR is a stopgap measure that only enhances the patient's viability for a period of time. The definitive treatment, whether in a hospital or out of hospital, is electricity delivered by defibrillators. AEDs are very simple to use. They don't have all the bells and whistles that you would see on a device for hospital use or by use of those of us in emergency medical services. They are light, compact, and can be stored easily. They are reusable. And that was a question that the chairman had for me here a few weeks ago. Police, in their roles of first responders, have been carrying these units for several years. I've been very surprised that we do not make sure that our state patrol vehicles are equipped with this valuable tool. In greater Minnesota, where ambulances' response times frequently preclude successful outcomes, we should be ensuring that all members of the state patrol have the means to intervene in the cases of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Now, Mr. Chairman, just so in terms of full disclosure, I do have an amendment that I will offer. Apparently it didn't get in the pack, and I thought it had been, but I will offer this in Transportation Finance Committee. And what we will do is we will make a couple technical changes, but I also want to make sure that the committee understands this is just not for greater Minnesota. This is for state patrol vehicles statewide. And so we'll be deleting the reference to greater Minnesota. However, it is my personal opinion this is where the greatest need is.
Okay. Any questions of the author? Do you have any other testimony that you care to
provide? I do. I have Mr. Steve Johnson, he's Olmsted County Deputy Sheriff.
Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate for me to distribute the...
We will, Paige. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if we could possibly get Mr. Johnson to hook that up to Mr. Paul and show us how it works.
I will activate it for you if you request.
If I may. Actually, to that point, it would not fire. It only fires on folks that are in actual cardiac arrest. That's what makes these things so valuable. They are dummy-proof, and they cannot deliver a shock that's not indicated.
So then you wouldn't mind if we had you demonstrate.
Well, I'm not going to press my luck, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, why don't we have Mr. Cornish, Representative Cornish, demonstrate?
You said it was dummy-proof.
I'm okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Deputy Johnson, go ahead.
My name is Steve Johnson. I'm Deputy Chief of Police for the Rochester Police Department. I'm wearing several other hats today, too. I'm ambassador for the National Center for Early Defibrillation, which is now becoming the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Association, member of the Midwest Cardiac Arrest Survivors Group, and most prevalent today, I'm speaking as an advocate for the American Heart Association. The Rochester Police Department was the first department in the world to implement an early defibrillation program that deployed AEDs and squad cars. I'm proud to say that we also have the best sudden cardiac arrest survival rate in the world for this type of program. The typical survival rate for victims of sudden cardiac arrest ranges between 2 and 10%. In Rochester, we are currently at about 46%, with an overall survival rate of 42% over the entire history of our program. Music. The problem is huge. There are various ways to measure survival rates. In Rochester, we only include those who suffered a witnessed ventricular fibrillation arrest and were subsequently discharged from hospitalization neurologically intact and mostly able to resume their pre-arrest lifestyles. This is a very solid standard. Some programs count anyone who makes it to the hospital as a survivor. If we use that measure, our survival rate would be at 70%. The problem is huge. Sudden cardiac death is estimated to affect around 250,000 people each year in the United States. That's more than five times the number of people killed on our nation's highways annually. What would you leaders think if all the sudden traffic fatalities went from 655 in 2004 to 3,275 in 2005? And what would you spend to stop that? Think of what we spend each year trying to reduce traffic deaths. And don't get me wrong, that spending is very worthwhile. I'm not arguing that we should reduce those efforts. I just want to jog your thinking a bit. The State Patrol is asking for about $1 million. That is about the cost of four traffic signals across the state of Minnesota. Those four signals would be just a drop in the bucket compared to the overall spending on traffic safety. But take a look at the potential return on investment. I wish I was in a position to make solid promises, but of course I'm not. But if we could achieve a 42% save rate across this country, we could save potentially 105,000 lives annually. That is admittedly a pie-in-the-sky goal. But more realistically, if Minnesota could attain the 7 per 100,000 that Rochester has attained, we could save 280 Minnesotans each year. Sudden cardiac death is the single most unaddressed public safety issue now facing our society. Many of these deaths are unnecessary. We need to stop accepting sudden cardiac death as death by natural causes. These deaths are just as unnecessary as deaths due to traffic crashes and homicides. We need to stop being so complacent about these deaths. These are our friends, family members, neighbors, coworkers, and they're dying needlessly. I'd also like to point out that sudden cardiac death is not an old person's problem. Indeed, our survivors probably do tend to be over 50 years on average, but our youngest survivor that I can think of at the moment was 14 years old at the time. He is now 41. Some of our survivors are in their 30s and 40s. Sudden cardiac death can hit virtually anyone at any time. Law enforcement agencies are uniquely positioned to help deliver an effective treatment, that is, early CPR and early defibrillation. I have said that there are three secrets to our success in Rochester. They are response time. We do absolutely everything we can to try to reduce response time. The metaphorical chain of survival works best when there's no slack between the links in the chain. The links of the chain are early notification of EMS, early CPR, early defibrillation, and early advanced care. Dr. White's research has clearly demonstrated that police officers armed with AEDs can take a significant amount of slack out of that chain. And if I can comment on the chart that I distributed, this goes back to November of 1990 is when we started our official program, or study, actually. Since that time, this is as of December, these numbers are a little bit out of date. We've treated 202 patients. Police and fire have treated 104 of those, paramedics 98. We have this dichotomy so that we can tell the difference between prior to starting the study when only paramedics had defibrillators, and after the study was initiated when police officers started carrying them. If you look down there, 104 people treated by police, resuscitated with shocks only, 38 of them. This is where response time becomes obvious. Survivors from that group, 36, 95% chance, if you were defibrillated by a police officer with an AED with shocks only, your chances are 95% that you will go home. Resuscitated on scene, 71%. That's getting them to the hospital alive. Unfortunately, not all of them make it out of the hospital. But 46 of those fires, survivors, are from the police fire defibrillation group, and 39 from the paramedic side. Overall survival, 85. I think that is now about to become 87. We have a gentleman in the hospital right now that we hope will recover. Total resuscitated on scene, 140. It sometimes takes me a while to appreciate what these numbers say, but to me they say that early defibrillation is the key to saving lives. Forgive my lack of humility, but I boast only in hopes of inspiring others to join the cause. While we do have an excellent program in Rochester, there's nothing magical about what we do. Our early defibrillation program is easy to manage, has little overhead, no liability, and plenty of rewards for the community and the department. What we have done can be duplicated. I believe that every marked car in Minnesota should carry an AED. While we have had AEDs for more than 14 years, our officers have been assisting in resuscitations with defibrillators since about 1973 and serving as first responders since sometime in the 1930s. So in effect, we have many more than 86 survivors. Our work has proven that early defibrillation by police is highly effective. I believe there's no legitimate reason that each and every police department in the state should not have officers equipped and trained to respond as we do. Our program has also been published many times, articles in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of Emergency Medical Service, Resuscitation, and others have all published articles regarding our success. Our results have withstood the critical review of hundreds of medical doctors. Our program has been copied all across the country and around the world. I'm very proud that I have had the opportunity to be involved in a project that is responsible for saving many thousands of lives on this planet. I'm proud that Rochester is a leader in this regard, and yet with a burning of pride, it still bothers me greatly that only about 30% of law enforcement agencies across Minnesota are equipped with AEDs. I salute those agencies, but I wonder why so many Minnesotans are still left nearly unprotected from the threat of sudden cardiac death. And we in Rochester are working to change that one community at a time. The Minnesota legislature has seen fit in the past to allocate funds to help communities purchase AEDs, and I am extremely grateful for your eagerness to help save lives. But the progress has been painfully slow, maybe dead slow. In Minnesota, being only 30% proliferation, 1% per year is far too slow. We need to do something to improve that. And that's why I'm so proud of the State Patrol for stepping up to the challenge of launching an early defibrillation program. I believe that the State Patrol should get AEDs for several reasons. First, the State Patrol already serves as EMS first responders in many areas. I understand that they handled more than 4,000 medical calls in 2004. From personal experience, I also know that many accidents are caused by sudden cardiac arrest, and some accidents have caused a sudden cardiac arrest. In Rochester, I know offhand of 5 such incidents. 3 of those drivers are alive. In one of those cases, a speeder was pulled over by a state trooper and realized that the passenger of the vehicle was suffering a sudden cardiac arrest at that time. The trooper called for backup from a Rochester police officer, and we defibrillated that patient. So the State Patrol already has one save under their belt, in my book. Given what we know now about response times, it is unlikely that this person would have survived had they continued speeding to the hospital. Second, the State Patrol wants this equipment. 6 or 7 states are now considering legislation to mandate AEDs in all law enforcement vehicles. And while I appreciate the intent of such legislation to mandate in all law enforcement vehicles, I question whether or not an agency can be mandated to achieve excellence in their defibrillation program. I believe that dedicated, compassionate leadership is the essential element. So in my book, an agency that wants an AED program should get AEDs. For the State Patrol, the only barrier is financial. Third, deploying about 500 AEDs across the state of Minnesota will set a good example for other agencies. The State Patrol has an excellent reputation and is a leader among law enforcement in Minnesota and beyond. The public awareness resulting from this act will increase interest in defibrillation in other communities and other states. More programs will be developed as a result of the development of the State Patrol's initiative. In my opinion, there are two states that seem to lead the nation in progressive legislation. That's Minnesota and California. As those two states go, so follows the nation. Minnesota deserves to be a leader in the development of defibrillation programs, but I'm afraid we're starting to fall behind. I am convinced that the State Patrol will save lives with AEDs if they never even take them out of the boxes. I'm also certain that they will take them out of the boxes and save even more. I know that the fiscal situation in the state is not ideal, but there's nothing more honorable for the government to do than protect its citizens. I beg of you to pass this legislation. I also hope that at some point in the near future, we can discuss the possibility of enacting additional legislation that will act as a positive incentive to communities to publicly examine the sudden cardiac death issue and willingly seek to develop ways to reduce sudden cardiac death all across Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? If not, Representative Powell, excuse me, Representative Nelson.
I'm just curious, how much did one of these devices cost for a piece? And are you, because you're buying a group, are you getting a better price?
Chairman Smith, Representative Nelson. These are on a state contract. I don't know the price right off the bat. The devices, there's a range of prices. The device we purchase is a high-end device that records audio and ECG and everything. It has an ECG screen on it, and that runs. I think we're getting them for about $2,400 to $2,500 a piece on the state contract. The lower end models that go for, I think, starting around $1,700, but I'm not certain. They are definitely economical, and the 15 saves that we had in 2003, the expenses I incurred, $1,500 operating expense annually, so it cost me $140 to save Charlie Butcher's life.
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I believe the one that was passed around that's sitting here, I believe that's about $1,500.
Very good. Any additional questions? That's the conclusion of your testimony, Representative Powell?
Well, I don't have my watch on. I can't see the clock, so I don't know where we're at. But I do have a survivor here.
We're at the end of your testimony, but if you have
I have a survivor here that would probably like to say a few words.
Welcome, sir. If you'd give us your name and then go ahead.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Charlie Buttruff. I'm a sudden cardiac arrest survivor. I was born and raised in southeastern Minnesota. I'm a veteran, a retired IBMer, and married the love of my wife, Sandra, for over 41 years. Through those years, Sandra and I were blessed with three sons, and they presented us with three granddaughters. But to get to my event, on the morning of November 18th, 2003, we rose about 7:30 a.m., did our usual thing, just get ready for the day. After breakfast and a two-hour shopping trip, we returned home and started putting things away. I felt a little tired at that point and told my wife I would help her finish up after a short nap in my favorite chair. Shortly after I closed my eyes, I drifted off to sleep. Sandy continued to put things away, and then a few minutes later she had a question she tried to ask me, but I didn't respond. She shook me, still nothing. She also noticed that my tongue was darting in and out of my mouth. At that point, she called 911. Within minutes, the police were there. They were the first to arrive. It was 4.8 minutes from dispatch to having the AED attached and activated. One shock, and in 5.2 minutes, I was back amongst the living. Time is extremely critical when dealing with sudden cardiac arrest. I remember very little of the next few days, but then on November 21st, I had surgery for a quintuple bypass. I then spent the better part of the next 2 weeks recovering in the hospital, and after that, on to rehab. That was over a year ago. I'm still a big part of my family's life, just being a husband to my wife, father to my sons, and grandfather to my granddaughters. I will never be able to repay any of these dedicated and wonderful people, the police, the firemen, the EMS crew, for the medical or the medical staff, but especially my wife, Sandra, for the life that they gave me back. And to quote a very good friend of mine and a fellow survivor, Gene Johnson, every day is a bonus day. I'm here today because a police car had an AED. I am fortunate enough to live in a city that equips its police cars with AEDs. But not everybody in Minnesota is as fortunate as we are. I'm here today to ask you to take a first step in making that happen. Make our Minnesota State Patrol a leader in the area of placing AEDs in our state law enforcement vehicles. So that they may use them to save lives. I'd like to thank you very much for your time and listening to my story.
Thank you, Mr. Buckram. Mr. Doyle, did you have something else?
Mr. Chairman, O.J. Doyle, this time I'm here as a voluntary vice chair of the Public Advocacy Committee for the American Heart Association. I think it's important, just for the record, to note that this was not a request made by the Department of Public Safety or the State Patrol. This was an American Heart Association initiative that I was involved in over 2 years ago. We put it together. We discussed funds, but the patrol is not coming forward requesting these dollars. This is strictly our say on this, and I think it's important that the committee understand that.
But the record will reflect that statement. We're done.
Thank you.
Chairman Smith?
Yes, Deputy.
To clarify that, though, however, I have spoken with the president of the Troopers Association and the former chief of the State Patrol, Colonel Ann Beers, and they are willing and able and wanting this equipment as well. So it may have been AHA's initiative, but State Patrol is in favor.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. O.J. Doyle, is the American Heart Association then financial partners in this bill?
Mr. Doyle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, no. The Heart Association has, over the past roughly 5 years, been very involved in chain of survival legislation, and this is just another step in that chain of survival.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you. Now, if no one on the committee objects to my laying this bill over, I'm going to lay the bill over. Thank you. This meeting. Whoops. It's premature. Excuse me.
I object.
We're anxious to have a more full hearing later. We are going to renew the chair's motion that this bill be the motion that it be approved and be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. Discussion. Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.